This is a recording of a live Resolution Foundation event. We hope you find it some combination of interesting or entertaining. To read the research and access the event slides referenced in this episode, please visit the events section of our website. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this Resolution Foundation conference. Now, my name's Torsten Bell. I'm the Chief Executive of the Foundation, and we spend a lot of our lives travelling around the country, to all the nations and the regions, and we work on all things economic policy, because those are the things that shape living standards, and that's what our charity exists to spend its time on. But there isn't, although today may be something of an exception, there isn't enough national, in the UK sense, discussion of the lessons we can learn from right around the United Kingdom, from each of the different nations. And that is a big missed opportunity, partly because there are big policy interactions and you'll be staggered by how often people don't know what is happening in other parts of the United Kingdom that directly affect the decisions they are taking. But in a rather more worthy sense, and from those of us from an academic background, it's a missed opportunity to learn from each other, because lots of people are working on the same policy areas, they're taking different policy initiatives, and they're learning about what works, and I'm afraid often what didn't work. And ideally, those things would be known and understood. So today we're hosting a conference jointly with ourselves and PolicyWise. For those of you who don't know, PolicyWise, the Open University encourages comparative research and knowledge exchange right the way across the UK and Ireland. So all the things I just said we need more of, that is them. If you're not following them, you should be. And we think this is exactly the right time to be discussing it, because it's the 25th anniversary of probably the biggest constitutional change in most living memory outside of Brexit. We can come back to that later, I'm sure, later. But it's certainly the biggest constitutional change within the United Kingdom during my lifetime. And that duration is important. There's not a lot of point holding this conference 5 years into devolution, partly because the policy differences have grown, and in one way that is how the opportunity for learning comes. And over the longer the devolution experience has gone on, you see distinct policy and political cultures also emerging. So you just see there's more difference to be learned from, but also because the devolution settlement, as again we're going to come back to in a second, has evolved. It's now a far more comprehensive economic settlement than it was back in 1999, when we were very, very focused on public services and those parts of the state that were already run independently, but maybe not with democratic oversight. And 25 years means that we've had long enough for politicians to make their entire careers in a devolution era, which means that we have elder statesmen, not in the pejorative sense, before anyone gets offended, but in the sense of experienced statesmen and women who have lived in that environment and can tell us about it and have learned from the experiences of doing so. So the agenda for today, up on the screen here, means that because of that, 25 years has passed, we're going to be able to start and finish today's conference with two of the towering figures of that devolution era. So in a second, we're going to start with John Swinney, former Deputy First Minister of Scotland, who has lived and breathed every aspect of that over the 25 years. And then finishing us off this afternoon is going to be Mark Drakeford, until very recently the First Minister of Wales. Both, as I say, have the lived experience of economic and lots of other policy areas making over that period. And then in between, we're going to have two great panels. So you're going to first of all hear about the experience of tax and welfare policy making, people making different choices, experimentation, and what we've learned from those. And then in the second panel session, we're going to focus beyond some of those micro decisions onto some of the bigger picture questions of economic strategy, growth and spending, different approaches to economic policy making. Now, obviously, there'll be something of an artificial split between those two panels. I don't believe anyone has got enough discipline not to mention tax changes in the second one, and vice versa, but you can't have it all in life. So we've got brilliant speakers. What do you need to deal with brilliant speakers? Because otherwise they go on too long. You need a brilliant chair. So luckily you have one. So for those panels, Clodagh Rice, business correspondent for BBC Northern Ireland. Thank you very much indeed, Clodagh, for coming this morning. She's also fresh from the Northern Ireland budget last week. And then all of you, both online and in the room, can ask questions on Slido. It's hashtag economic lessons. As I said to the team, that is the worthiest hashtag of all time. If you're in the room, you can also ask questions using your hand and mouth. We'd encourage that in the right way. Hand up, then you ask the question with your mouth, yeah? Right, but to kick us off, we're going to start with John Swinney, who has seen it all. He's an MSP since 1999, although he told me this morning he thinks there's 10 left from 1999, which is more than I thought. So the he's held almost every senior cabinet role under Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon, and he was Deputy First Minister between 2014 and 2023. It's all gone downhill since then, but he's going to be too polite to say that. So, no one better to kick us off. Over to you, John. Ooh, excuse me.
Thank you very much, Thorsten, and I'm absolutely delighted to have the opportunity provided by the Resolution Foundation to reflect on 25 years of devolution. As Thorsten said, I have lived and breathed every bit of it, because not only have I been a member of the Scottish Parliament since its inception in 1999, I think I am the only remaining serving Member of Parliament in Scotland who voted for the Scotland Act in 1998 when it passed the House of Commons, having been elected in the 1997 general election, but made my choice to serve in the Scottish Parliament consistently thereafter. So this is a really welcome opportunity to reflect on what's frankly been the dominant period of my professional life, and a great privilege to do so. So thank you very much, Thorsten, for the invitation, and to the Resolution Foundation for providing the opportunity to reflect on what's been a really important journey, and I think there's lots of lessons to draw from that. On a flagstone in the Scottish Parliament building, there's an etching of some words from one of the strongest advocates of Scottish devolution, the late John P. McIntosh, who was the Labour MP for East Lothian until his untimely death in 1978. The etching reads, "People in Scotland want a degree of government for themselves. It is not beyond the wit of man to devise the institutions to meet these demands." Now, although an advocate and proponent of Scottish independence throughout my adult life, I accept that the aspiration set out by John P. McIntosh was, for the majority of people at that time, largely fulfilled when the structures that were designed in the Scotland Act 1998 were introduced. Those views have not, however, proven static. People in Scotland have not remained in the same position on the constitutional question they were in 1999. In the intervening years, political debate and sentiment have continued to wrestle with actually addressing the challenges laid down by John P. McIntosh, which was to design the structures and powers that best reflect the aspirations of people in Scotland. In general, the majority position over that period has been that people in Scotland wanted to have more powers than were devolved in 1999 to effect change. Further powers have been devolved in roughly three tranches that have, to a greater or lesser degree, better met the aspirations of people in Scotland, but not yet in their entirety. The original devolution proposition that came into effect in 1999, I believe, was a genuine attempt to address the democratic deficit in Scotland. It was designed to put the responsibilities that had been exercised in the pre-devolution era within administratively devolved structures of the Secretary of State for Scotland under effective democratic control. No longer would people in Scotland have policies pursued that had been put in place by governments that did not command a legitimate mandate from the people of Scotland. So the original devolution settlement gave the Scottish Parliament no more powers and no greater budget than had existed under administrative devolution, with the exception of the rather blunt taxation mechanism of varying the basic rate of income tax by 3p in the pound. But it did democratise the handling of these powers, and I'll come later to the innovation that that process enabled. Those original powers remained largely unaltered until the Scotland Act 2012, with the exception of powers on control of the rail industry that were devolved under the Railways Act 2005, which enabled Scottish ministers to determine railway policy in Scotland, including management of the ScotRail franchise, infrastructure and fare levels. These powers over the rail network have been used effectively to expand the scope of the rail network, with six new rail projects opening since the powers were devolved, providing greater opportunities for modal shift, and also to bring the network into public ownership where it now sits. The second tranche of powers came in the Scotland Act 2012 that brought forward legislation arising from the Calman Commission, which was established by the Unionist parties in the Scottish Parliament as an alternative forum to the constitutional agenda of the minority SNP government of the time. It produced powers to set rates of income tax in Scotland, to design land and landfill and stamp duty taxes, to enable very limited borrowing, and provide some further powers over drink driving and firearms, which were public issues of debate at the time. The Scottish Government moved quickly to establish replacement taxes for landfill tax and stamp duty, with the introduction of land and buildings transaction tax being undertaken in a way to reduce the burden on lower priced properties to assist a policy objective of assisting those on low incomes. The income tax powers, however, remained too blunt to be deployed, with the requirement to vary each income tax rate by the same margin meaning that they did not give the opportunity to reduce the tax burden for lower earners without providing a greater benefit for higher earners. As a result, I was not willing to deploy those powers. The limitation on the use of the powers therefore impeded the adoption of a policy that would have been within the prevailing policy ambition of the Scottish Government. The opportunity to pursue tax and social security policies that were more suitable to Scotland came with a third tranche of powers, devolved in the Scotland Act 2016, which emerged from the Smith Commission proposals. In the aftermath of the independence referendum, the UK Prime Minister established the Smith Commission, including representatives of all five Scottish parliamentary parties of the time. I was one of its members. The Commission recommended a range of powers be devolved, including the power to set income tax rates and bans in Scotland, although not the personal allowance, to have greater but still limited borrowing abilities, responsibility for air passenger duty, and powers to set and administer a number of benefits, including disability living allowance, the personal independence payment, the winter fuel payment, the creation of new benefits, powers to alter the bedroom tax, and to have greater control over the Crown estate. It also recommended that a share of VAT be allocated to Scotland as part of the annual financial settlement, largely so that the UK parties could claim that 50% of Scotland's budget was devolved, but proposed no powers to change VAT levels. The Scotland Act 2016 finally enabled a great deal more variance to be established in policy making through the use of some tax and welfare levers that had previously not been available. In using these powers since 2016, the Scottish Government has created a distinct tax policy, with measures being taken that have required people on higher incomes to pay more in taxation than if they lived in the rest of the United Kingdom. The fiscal impact of such measures is assessed by the Scottish Fiscal Commission, a body independent of the Scottish Government, and the conclusions of that analysis are shared with Parliament as ministers set out their budget proposals. The utilisation of these powers now generates over £1 billion in public expenditure that would not have been available had these powers not been used. This has expanded the resources available to the Scottish Parliament. The devolution of a range of welfare powers has seen some benefits devolve for delivery in Scotland, and the opportunity created to develop new benefits. The principal, and I would contend most impactful, has been the creation of the Scottish Child Payment. The first Scottish Child Payments began in February 2021 at the rate of £10 a week for each child under six, where the parent is eligible for a qualifying benefit, such as universal credit. Doubling of the payment to £20 a week per child was rolled out from April 2022 in advance of the expected extension of the eligibility to under 16s. A system of bridging payments was put in place for children between 6 and 16, in effect advancing a formal rollout, and the payment increased to £25 a week per child, and eligibility was formally extended to under 16s in November 2022. The purpose of the payment is to make a direct impact on family income to address child poverty. To assess the difference this makes, a family with three children will receive an additional £3,900 a year, a significant addition to a low-income household. It is a regular payment, and modelling puts the impact on child poverty rates at a reduction of approximately 5%. The latest statistics show payments have been made in respect of just over 316,000 children, and Scotland now has a relative child poverty rate of 24% compared to a UK level of 30%. Professor Danny Dorling recently described the Scottish Child Payment as the single policy intervention that has created the largest fall in child poverty anywhere in Europe for at least 40 years. The Scottish Child Payment represents a formidable intervention using devolved powers to deliver a different policy outcome in the wake of prevailing UK policies. The other area of interest in this discussion is on policy differentiation in relation to economic policy. One of the concerns I had during the Smith Commission was that the package proposed was imbalanced. Scope was created to develop new approaches on welfare, but there were insufficient powers to boost the size and the direction of the economy, a critical requirement if different social policy paths are to be paid for. Despite the expansion of the powers of the Parliament, the scope for significant divergence in approaches to the management of the economy and the creation of new economic opportunities remain limited to the powers that were available at the onset of devolution. A range of interventions have been taken by successive Scottish governments to stimulate economic growth. The first approach, going back to the early devolved governments, has been to establish and expand a network of international offices to promote Scottish economic opportunities in a number of critical markets around the globe. This has provided a valuable platform and connection point for Scottish companies overseas and a sustained base for Scottish Development International to bring together all relevant interested parties to maximise the business and trading opportunities for Scotland overseas. This has been a critical platform for the Scotch whisky industry, energy interests and life science organisations. Now there's been a great amount actually, in my personal experience, of practical cooperation with UK embassies across the globe. But there is now, unfortunately, an increasing amount of political noise from the UK government about how these arrangements work, and I regret that. The second area has been to maintain a network of economic agencies across Scotland dedicated to supporting the company base to expand. These organisations, Scottish Enterprise, Highlands Ands Enterprise, and the South of Scotland Enterprise, have been key players in enabling strategic economic developments to happen. Two of the finest examples I would cite are the approach of Scottish Enterprise in leading a consortium of universities, health boards, local authorities to create the Edinburgh BioQuarter, which has created a phenomenal life sciences cluster around the Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh. And the other is the establishment by Highlands Ands Enterprise of the Beechwood campus in Inverness, which has been a driving force of the development of the Highland capital, the significant expansion of the Highland capital, with the attraction of major organisations and educational institutions to be based in that area, fueling the process of economic growth in the north of Scotland. The critical role of the agencies in drawing all of this together cannot be understated. I watched in utter bemusement as the United Kingdom government dismantled regional economic structures after 2010 and experienced an inevitable loss of impetus in economic development as a consequence. The third area is in skills development and alignment between educational institutions and business activity. The development of the Foundation, Modern and Graduate Apprenticeship programmes, the focus on ensuring young people leave school for positive destinations, and broadening access to higher and further education have all combined to deliver higher levels of engagement in the workforce in Scotland. The fourth area is in efforts to reduce direct costs for business. Probably the key example of this is the Small Business Bonus Scheme, introduced by the SNP government in 2007, which removes approximately 100,000 small businesses from the payment of business rates. This measure has been designed to support local economies and sustain businesses in communities. The fifth area has been the design of infrastructure to support innovation and to address the need to improve the level of business startups in Scotland. It's commonly referred to as the innovation ecosystem. The issue of business startup has been a historic problem within Scotland, but the focus of this work has successfully increased the level of business startup in Scotland. And the innovation ecosystem is now focusing on the question of scale-up with the introduction by the government of a number of tech scalers which are designed to fuel that process around the country. And finally, the enhancement of the physical infrastructure of Scotland through the sustained capital investment programme. This has included the construction of the new Queensferry Crossing, the Aberdeen Western Peripheral Route, the completion of the Central Scotland Motorway Network, the significant electrification of the rail network, the opening of six new rail routes, including a railway to the Scottish borders, and the establishment of hundreds of early learning and childcare centres around the country to deliver expanded early years provision, which is often seen as a social intervention. But for me, in authorising that work, it was motivated as an economic intervention to enable greater participation in the labour market. These six themes illustrate the approaches that have been taken to assist economic development, but it should be stressed that all of these actions were possible within the original powers for the Parliament, set for the Parliament in 1999. Meeting the demand for the Parliament to be able to intervene in economic activity to a greater extent would undoubtedly require further powers to be awarded, and I believe that is a valid and important part of the debate about the appropriate powers for the Parliament. In considering the events of the last 25 years, it is important to reflect that devolution was designed to address the democratic deficit in Scotland, not initially at least a deficit of powers, but the democratic responsibility has enabled policy interventions that has led to different approaches being taken in different parts of the United Kingdom. That is an inherent characteristic of any devolved structure of governance. Why would a political system establish devolved structures without accepting there will be differences in the approaches to be taken, and therefore an inevitable, and I would say welcome, level of innovation? Amongst the legislative measures that have been taken forward by the Scottish Parliament have been measures that the Westminster Parliament just simply never had the time or the space to get round to addressing. One of the first acts passed by the Scottish Parliament was an example of this type of issue, the Abolition of Feudal Tenure Scotland Act 2000. This significant reform of our system of land ownership was followed in 2003 by the Land Reform Scotland Act, which enshrined in law the right of responsible access in Scotland. These were two major policy measures that emerged because the Scottish Parliament was able to address long-running issues that had never been prioritised. Hence, the democratic aspirations of people in Scotland were addressed as a consequence. There have also been substantial legislative instruments to address problems deeply ingrained in Scottish society on major public health issues. The Smoking Health and Social Care Scotland Act 2005 banned smoking in public places, leading the way within the United Kingdom. Without the power to tax alcohol, the Scottish Parliament legislated for the provision of minimum unit pricing of alcohol through the Alcohol Minimum Pricing Scotland Act 2012. These were policy innovations that have demonstrated the benefit of taking different initiatives in different parts of the United Kingdom. Major reforms have been legislated for to improve the well-being of individuals through the Community Care and Health Scotland Act 2002, which introduced free personal care, and the Public Bodies Joint Working Scotland Act 2014, a rather mechanistic title, but the Act provided for the integration of health and social care services at local level, which enabled the creation of a more cohesive set of services to meet the demands of vulnerable individuals in society. Aside from legislation, devolution enabled the government in Scotland to pursue policy initiatives that were, at first sight, excluded from the areas of responsibility of the Scottish Parliament. Policy initiatives such as the establishment of the Fresh Talent Scheme in 2004, which enabled international students to stay longer in Scotland to help boost population growth. Or the introduction of the Malawi International Development Programme, which enabled Scotland to support development in Malawi. These were both initiatives undertaken in expressly reserved areas, but enabled by agreement with the Home Office and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, respectively. We live now, however, in changed days. It is inconceivable that the current, rather aggressive United Kingdom government would countenance any encroachment by the Scottish Parliament or the Scottish Government on currently reserved areas, certainly not on an issue of migration and population growth. The prevailing political culture has, not surprisingly, had a significant impact on the nature of policy making within the Scottish Parliament. That political culture has been shaped by two factors. The structure of government that has been in place at any given time, minority, majority, coalition, all sorts of shapes and forms, and also by the condition of the constitutional argument on independence. In general, up to 2014, I think it's fair to say there was a prevailing political culture across all parties that was keen to get things done, to try to find ways of creating agreement, to make use of the powers of devolution to improve the lives of people in Scotland. I think it's also fair to say that the prevailing political culture today makes it more difficult to get things done than at any previous point in the devolution experience. In the last 25 years, there have been multiple examples of the use of the powers of the Scottish Parliament with significant effect in Scotland. As the powers of the Parliament have expanded over this period, so has the impact of the Parliament, especially in areas of taxation and welfare. The dynamics of the work of the Parliament do not take their course in isolation. They are significantly affected by the prevailing political and economic context in the United Kingdom. That context has changed over time. During the period of the Labour government until 2010, there was a prevailing political and economic direction in the United Kingdom that the Scottish Parliament and government, whether Labour or SNP-led, was able to complement. That resulted in significant progress in the erosion of poverty levels in Scotland due to the combined efforts of the UK and Scottish governments. Since 2010, that prevailing direction has changed, and the Scottish Government has had to act to achieve its policy objectives, especially in tackling poverty, in the face of that challenging and different prevailing political direction. That results in some of the additionality that should come from measures like the Scottish Child Payment being lost, while steps have to be taken to mitigate UK measures like the benefit cap. At present, the Scottish Government is wrestling, and not for the first time, with the impact of a decision to cut capital spending at UK level. And that has an effect on the finances available to Scotland to invest in our own infrastructure, including the important transition to net zero. For the last few years, this unhelpful policy direction has been added to by a hostile outlook from the UK government towards devolution, formed by the UK government's response to Brexit. Before the Brexit process, the UK government had never legislated in devolved areas without consent from the Scottish Parliament. It has now done so on 11 occasions. For most of the devolution years, the UK government has been a rather benign presence in the operation of the devolved structures. That is different now, and should future UK governments take the same attitude, it would pose a real threat to the prospects and the effectiveness of devolution. A key element of the devolution journey has been the relationship between the devolved governments of the United Kingdom. In my experience, despite political leadership that has stretched right across the political spectrum, all three devolved governments worked well together and often in concert with issues that everybody shared in advancing our respective policy objectives with the United Kingdom government. In general, we tended to share the same perspective in advancing our issues in relation to the UK government. Let me conclude with some final observations on what this journey of devolution has achieved for people in Scotland. In short, and without rose-tinted spectacles, I believe devolution has improved the governance of Scotland. The work of the Scottish Parliament, its committees, and its structure of scrutiny has delivered greater and more effective democratic accountability in Scotland. Governments that have included members of four political parties, Labour, Liberal Democrat, SNP, and Green, have delivered bold social and economic policies. Yes, there have been constraints, and yes, there have been failings. But there has often also been a willingness to stretch the boundaries of devolution to find solutions that address fundamental challenges facing the people of Scotland on public health, welfare, and migration. That would not have been possible without devolution, and Scotland is the better for it. In looking to the future, I am, of course, an independence supporter, but I also care about the progress of devolution. I'm concerned that the ability of our current devolved powers to meet the aspirations of the people in the current constitutional setup is being eroded. We are not currently meeting the test set by John P. McIntosh. Over the last few years, the UK government has disrespected devolution and used Brexit as an excuse to structurally and legislatively constrain the scope for action of the devolved institutions. A change of UK government provides the opportunity to re-establish the purpose of devolution and to equip the Scottish Parliament with the economic powers that would enable it to operate in a much more cohesive and emphatic way in its policy interventions. The period ahead will tell whether that prospect will be delivered. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you very much. John, we covered a lot of ground there that we're going to try to dig into, covering powers, political culture, policy decisions and outcomes. There's loads of great questions on Slido already, but it's a reminder that you can put more on there on hashtag economic lessons, or you can put your hand up in the room. I thought one of the great things about your reflections, as I said at the beginning, benefiting from you having been there pre-1999, as you reminded us, is to take that historical sweep. And I think some of the democratic arguments for where we ended up in 99 maybe get lost in the technocratic day-to-day of getting through lots of decisions. So just let's start by taking you back to 1999 on two questions. So the first would, how successful did you expect devolution to be compared to what's actually then happened?
I thought devolution would make a profound impact because of the ability to address those significant questions that Westminster, and this is, you know, this is no criticism of Westminster, there's loads of issues got to be wrestled with in the United Kingdom Parliament, just never got around to doing. So land reform was an issue that people were really concerned about in Scotland, and it just would never have made it up the agenda in Westminster, but the Scottish Parliament could address that. I think it's important to remember that in actually the early days of devolution, the Parliament became really quite unpopular. A bit of that was driven, I think, by two things. One was the building project went completely off the rails and cost a lot more than was anticipated.
To remind everyone which building project we mean.
The Parliament building project, it was estimated in the white paper to cost 40 million. It cost £440 million. So it was kind of...
It was suboptimal.
It was, but the building's lovely, but it was much
more
expensive.
The building's not suboptimal, the cost was.
The costing was. Yeah. And then the second thing was that I think people probably expected the world to change like that in 1999. And it didn't. So I hope what I've set out today says that over a quarter of a century, I think Scotland's a very, very different place with a very different legislative structure and footprint. So yes, I think it has been profound change. But go back to, you know, if you looked at a poll in 2001 and people were really half-hearted about the Parliament, what's this done for us? But I think when you look back over, but it's exactly your point in the introduction, look back over that period of years, and you can see there's a profound impact.
Great. That actually generally is a thing we see, which is when you ask people, would you like some more politicians? They're often not massively enthusiastic. I know you all are, obviously. But they're not. But the lived experience, we see it in Manchester now, once you've got a visible... Because of the democratic benefit, the having a visibility, the accountability, people do tend to be perkier afterwards than at the time.
And the other thing is that very, very quickly... the Scottish Parliament became the focal point of Scottish political debate. So it shifted dramatically.
Do you think that was actually a shock to some of the people that were pro-devolution? The degree to which, because I completely agree.
Yes, I think people were a bit taken aback by the extent to which it all really came into...
Like those MPs that didn't follow you.
Yeah, you know, and there was that change of focus, I think, left Scottish MPs at Westminster a bit wondering what the role in life was.
I mean, we all got that angst, but yes, I agree. That was definitely around all through the 2000s. Right, last thing on the question on the looking back to 25 years. So one of the big themes of your remarks is the evolution of devolution. Right, it's changed very significantly, particularly in the economic sphere. Did you think it would change? It would evolve that much?
I suppose it's best to say that I was optimistic it would. I couldn't have been certain about it, but I felt that as the Parliament, it was interesting listening to debate in Parliament, and I don't just include my perspective, and my cards are on the table, I'm an independent supporter, I want the Parliament to be able to do everything. But it's interesting listening to my colleagues who come from unionist parties. They also wanted the Parliament to do more. So it wasn't something that was just contained in our group. Others wanted the Parliament to be more impactful, to be able to do bolder things, to take bigger initiatives. So there was actually quite a bit of pushing to do
more. To the direction of travel.
And if you take that example, you know, the Fresh Talent Initiative in 2004, which was about migration, that was advanced by the former First Minister, Jack McConnell, Labour First Minister. He sought my support as leader of the SNP at that time for this, that we would support him, and we did. And he successfully negotiated with the Home Office, and it was a good thing.
Very good. Right, let's take some of the questions that people are asking online. The most popular one is probably not a surprise. No, we're coming to that one later. Is on what else? So if you're allowed one other power, what's the biggest ask for the next evolution of powers?
I think the area that's got to be explored is are the powers to create significantly more economic opportunity. And I think those relate to areas around about employment policy, around business policy, and around population policy, because we all know that population growth is a significant driver of economic growth. We face a challenge. If you go back again over the 25 years, Scotland was facing an acute challenge about the size of its working age population in the early part of the 21st century, with great alarm been expressed and great leadership been given by the Labour executive of the time about this question, which is where the Fresh Talent Initiative came from. These concerns were largely addressed by EU expansion in 2004 and the migration that followed from that. So our working age population grew, and it's not been certainly nothing like the critical factor it was in 2000. It's now a critical factor post-Brexit because of the challenges about migration. So I think that's the scope, and my concern during the Smith Commission was that the additional powers were welcome. How on earth could I stand in the way of more powers coming to Scottish Parliament, Scottish Nationalist? But I was concerned about the balance of those powers not giving sufficient opportunity to build and support economic growth.
So since you raised that, was the one thing you find, you spent a lot of time around in Holyrood, a lot of people who were, let's say, less optimistic or positive than you were about devolution, one of the things that made them in the end come round to more devolution of tax raising powers, far more, it's a radically transformed settlement from 1999, was that they thought more tax devolution would help shift discussion in Holyrood towards growth issues. And so more on how to grow the pie and a bit less on the distribution of the pie. I think you'd probably say that hasn't happened hugely, but maybe I'm being unfair. What do you think?
I think that's probably fair, that I don't think the Parliament is as focused on how it can grow the resources that are available to it than it could be. And I think that's a product of the limitations on the scope of the Parliament being able to act in that direction.
Okay, so you think it's internal markets.
So what I was trying to say in my speech is that I think the Parliament has stretched the boundaries, it's tried to push the boat out to do more, but the limitation is that, it's tried to do that within the existing arrangements, and I'm very open to what more can Parliament do within its powers to encourage greater growth and dynamism, but the issue you will often rub up against is that there are limitations on the powers to make that difference.
Definitely. Let's move on to, so you talk quite a bit about how the political culture has changed over those 25 years in phases. So there's one thing on the political culture, then I want to come to the policy-making culture, which is probably not talked about much in public. But on the political culture, you're seeing basically some time between 2014 and 2016 as a tipping point in the nature, in particular, of the relationship between the UK government and the devolved administration, but possibly also in politics. So is that change around that point, do you see it being driven by who's in government in the UK level, the 2014 referendum or the 2016 referendum? Like, what's the trigger for you seeing that as the central move?
I think there's two components of that. There's the internal political culture of the Scottish Parliament,
yep.
and there's the political culture as influenced by the engagement with the United Kingdom government. On the internal question in the Scottish Parliament, I think basically the nature of that culture has changed largely in the period around about 2014 because of the impact of the independence referendum, where I think the pro-union parties are not are prepared to give much less ground or scope to an SNP government to act. And then also it's affected by the significant dominance, political dominance of the Parliament by the SNP electorally. So that creates the internal culture of the SNP now. It wasn't like that before. If I go back to the 2007 to 2011 period where I was part of a minority government in which we had 47 out of 129 members. I remember being told we're having a minority government with 47 out of 129, thinking,
this will be fun.
How on earth is this going to work? But there was enough goodwill to get our way through that and to govern effectively and for Parliament to legislate effectively. So those numbers were not an impediment. But it did change with those factors. The second thing is the relationship with the UK government. And it does come back to my point about the UK government being quite a benign presence around about devolution for most of the last 25 years. I always felt that there's always prickly issues to resolve. I was a finance minister for many years. You never really have a discussion about money without it being a bit fraught, So there was always, but fundamentally good working arrangements. I think what changed was really around about, and actually I should say that in the period of the coalition government between the Conservatives and the Liberals, 2010 to 2015, I actually thought those years were probably the most respectful years in relation to the interaction between the devolved governments and the UK government. And I think that was the operating culture at that time was pretty good. It's gone.
Why did you go on? I did not expect you to say that. So why?
I think the George Osborne and invariably Danny Alexander, Liberal Democrat, I think they both believed in the concept of devolution. So they were devolving power
respectful
in England.
I see, yeah.
So it wasn't so I can't remember all the structures that were going on in England, but they were tending to
They were arguing for the
Northern Powerhouse stuff and all that material. I felt that I was dealing with believers in devolution.
Okay.
And they were also at a personal level there was respectful relations. I have to say it's gone absolutely down the stank since Brexit. Totally down the stank, and it's terrible just now. And so I'm able to say, I think fairly dispassionately, there have been really good periods of engagement. This is terrible.
Okay. So there's quite a few questions, and the gentleman and lady from the press have got themselves up and running. So this is a good day to hold a conference on devolution, because there's things happening in Holyrood. I think you might have noticed. So there's two questions. There's just one. What are you expecting to happen today? Where on earth is Scottish politics going?
Obviously, we face a difficult day today. The First Minister is, I understand, going to make a statement later on today. I think it's probably best at this stage if I let the First Minister speak for himself and to set out his position. And I'm quite sure more has to be said in the course of the rest of the day and the rest of the week.
There's one question more personally for you from Tim Wallace, who was it's a hypothetical question. And Tim is probably aware of how politicians often respond to hypothetical questions. But the question is, if the First Minister does step down, would you like to be First Minister? I think this might be an easy one, but
it is a hypothetical question. So I'm going to take the traditional approach of saying it's a hypothetical question. But I think it's a very demanding role to be the First Minister of Scotland. I've been very close to it and for many, many years, so it takes a lot of thinking about.
Very good. Right, let's do one. Let's take one question from the floor, and then I want to do one each on tax and benefits, and then we'll wrap up. Go ahead, sir.
Lovely. Hi, John. Another Swinney, Paul Swinney from Centre for Cities. Don't often meet another Swinney.
All right.
Devolution, obviously agree that is a good thing, but in Scotland and in Wales, it's sort of gone down to the National Parliament, but then hasn't gone any further. So there's been very little powers that are being passed down to a more local level. What's your reflection on that, and what do you think might happen in the future in that regard?
I think I generally come into my politics with the view that decisions are best taken as close to people as you possibly can do. So I do support empowering local authorities, and I think some headway has been made on that. You know, the Scottish Parliament just now is legislating for a visitor levy bill, for example, which would give a local authority the power to decide if it wants to put an overnight charge on hotel accommodation, things like that. So that's one example of a re-empowerment of local authorities, and we have taken other steps to create that discussion. I think one of the challenges of that question is that often where powers are held by local authorities, it is often the Scottish Government held to account for the performance around those powers. So there's an issue about the degree to which, and it comes back to the point I was making a moment ago, that Holyrood has become the focal point of all political debate. So even though a local authority decision might be taken at the other end of the country, the implications of that tend to become the responsibility of the Scottish Government. And that's, you know, that obviously raises some challenging questions about political accountability.
Right, let's take two quick questions and then wrap up. So go ahead, Lady.
Okay, thank you very much. You talked about skills development and the approach that you're taking in Scotland. It sounds as if you're moving towards the idea of a broader tertiary sector along the lines of Wales for post-compulsory education. From England, we look at post-compulsory education in Scotland and think, oh, they've got it wrong about fees because free university is great, but it limits participation. How do you square that circle, and what do you think England can learn from the approach that you're taking on skills development?
And let's just take one more question right at the back, so we're going to overrun.
Just turning to the events again today, would you be prepared to step in as SNP leader if it's what it takes to prevent a vote of no confidence in the Scottish Government?
Well, two rather different questions.
On the first question, the experience of, for example, providing free university tuition has led to an expansion of our participation in university education. It's led to an expansion of domiciled Scots participating in education. It's also led to, with the priorities we've applied on access to higher education, a greater proportion of young people from areas of deprivation accessing higher education. So I would contend that has actually broadened participation. But I would also say, and the reason why I cited the apprenticeship options, is that I think what we've managed to make a lot of headway on is about aligning the requirements of the labour market with the arrangements within our college structure particularly. But your starting point of trying to create a more integrated tertiary sector is very much the policy objective, so that we try to blur some of those boundaries between what happens in a school, what happens in a college, what happens in the university, to enable a much more effective learner journey, which results in increased participation in the economy. So I think that's the principal lesson I would identify from the experience in Scotland. In relation to the question about events today, obviously the First Minister is going to make a statement later on. I will consider what the First Minister says and reflect on that. I think it's important that we hear very much what the First Minister says later on today, and I may well have more to say at a later stage during the week.
Great. Look, can we all thank Don for his remarks this morning, particularly for the reflective nature of them, which is quite unusual in our world. So thank you very much indeed for those. And we should also say, in a world where it does feel like politics, I don't want to say it's a fast churn game, but it's a faster churn game than it was 25 years ago, certainly, for people who are prepared to commit basically their entire working lives to politics and to public services, a thing that allows us to have this kind of reflective conversation. So thank you for those as well. So we can release you to what I'm sure isn't going to be the most relaxing day, John, but I hope you enjoyed the beginning of it for the... very good, very good. Thanks again, John.
Thank you for listening to this Resolution Foundation event. You can find more episodes and the latest living standards research on the Resolution Foundation website.